Accession number 13114, Reel 6.
Because with the radar that the fighter command fitted, which was the 17 and the Mark 22, you were confined to a stern chase. And it's interesting because I got MOS agreement to take part in one of the Armed Forces annual exercises when we were chasing cameras and things about over the North Sea, and that was quite interesting. Canberra gave you a jolly good run for your money, really, because it could not presumably when it was loaded, but unloaded, of course, it could get higher than you could. But it's an interesting little exercise. What else?
What was the Javelin's typical performance of around 40,000? I mean?
Oh, gosh, like 40,000, I can't remember now. It took a terrible long time to accelerate. The later, last ones, of course, had reheat. I can't remember what it would do on the level, about 0.9, I think, or something like that. Not very fast.
It was a thin wing Javelin mooted at one time, wasn't it?
That's right. We tried as a private venture. We did all the drawings and I think a little bit of preliminary mock-up on it. And the ministry wouldn't have it. And we also tried to persuade the ministry to put the AI-18 in them. And in fact, we did an 18 installation, but the answer to that was there weren't enough sets in production because they all were going to the Navy. It was a strange old aeroplane, that Javelin. We had a pretty eerie time having to spin the damn thing, which was very unpleasant. Had a most peculiar spin, did the Javelin. We never cleared it for use in the service, but it was very unpredictable. Sometimes it would come out almost straight away. Other times you had a terrible, terrible struggle to get it out. One of the bravest efforts was I can't remember his name now. It's gone. Chap who ended up as a director of the RE. I ought to know his name. Tom Kerr. Tom Kerr was then the great spinning expert at the RE. And we had a good laugh over this because he made the most splendid, quite large models of the Javelin to drop out of balloon baskets with clockwork mechanism to see how this thing got out of the spin. But we'd done all the actual full-scale ones before Tom actually dropped one out of the basket, which was rather fun. But anyway, I thought he was jolly brave because he came one day in the back of the thing while I was spinning it, and it really was, I thought, a pretty stalwart effort because it was a pretty shaky aeroplane, really. Anyway, we eventually thought we'd got it hacked. We'd sent it to Boscombe down, but unfortunately the lady there failed to get it out, and it spun it in, which is rather sad. Anyway, he got out. That was the main thing.
Did you ever experience a deep stall in it?
Oh, Lord, yes. I mean,
you did a lot of stalling at half CG a lot.
Well, yeah, I mean, the thing is that when it went into the stall, flaps up, you couldn't stop it stalling. Towards the end, it pitched up, stalled, and then it spun in varying degrees, depending how you'd entered it. This was really the problem. So, anyway, it didn't really matter in the end because it was cleared to the service without a stalling or spinning category.
You mentioned that you'd flown the Sea Vixen. Can you give me a sort of comparative rundown between the two?
Well, I merely thought that I remember going to the Havilands and having a go in this thing, and I was agreeably surprised that poor old Javelin was hinged with restrictions of various sorts. But when I asked what the restrictions were on the Vixen I was about to fly, I think they said 600 knots and 5.5 G. I said, what, nothing else? Said, no, off you go. Which was pretty good.
It was a much sleeker, more aerodynamic-looking aeroplane. Is that the case? Did it have
some very clever things. It had a very clever gear change on the elevator control, which worked extremely well. So that, I mean, the Javelin, I mean, you could get it going supersonic, but you had to poke it downhill. And while you were going from sort of 0.97 to whatever, 101, you couldn't really do anything with it at all. It was just, the stick made very little difference. But on the Sea Vixen, it was very controllable. I thought it was very good.
They both have power controls, presumably.
Yes. Yeah. But they had this very clever gearing change. Can't remember how it was done, but it was very, I thought it was jolly good. Really do.
Would you say that it was therefore a superior aircraft, the Javelin, for the same job?
I don't know what it was like at high altitude, because I think that I can't remember what engines the one I flew had. Abrams, would they mean? Would they? And I don't know what sort of level speed the thing did. I'd have thought it would have been. A better aeroplane to have developed than Javelin myself. Javelin I've always regarded as a pretty sort of interim aeroplane, really. Before people have really got the measure of this delta configuration and the high tail business, you see.
They were both very big aeroplanes, weren't they?
Yes, they were. Yes. I forget how much the ultimate Javelin weighed. Quite a lot, about 45,000 pounds, I think. Yes, it was a big aeroplane.
And a lot of that was presumably still thermionic valve levels in the electronics, yeah, and so on.
Yes, yeah, some pretty heavy stuff. I think.
Masses of cooling.
Yeah, and the structure was pretty. And yes, of course, it carried, don't forget, it also carried. All the later versions, of course, had these air to air missiles, but the first ones had four Edens, which were fairly heavy.
30mm cannons.
Yeah, the German gun cut down and so on. Yeah.
Well, that was a German designer, wasn't it?
Yes. Yeah.
And how long were your Aftlosters?
Well, I see from my logbook, I left them in 1960, so it must be about 7 years. Mm-hmm. And towards the end of that time, I was doing quite a bit of flying for AWA Bitterswell on the Argosy, which ran into a tremendously long stalling and lateral and directional stability program. So my number two at Gloucester, Peter Varley, and I took it in turns to do chunks of this program. And then...
That was, I suppose, due to its bluff shape, because I gather you had they had the same directional stability problems on the C-119.
Part of it was the fact that the civil stalling restrictions were so very, very tight, and the business was to try and get rid of the wing drop. Well, it had the Argosy had a Shackleton wing. And the Shackleton wing stalled without any warning at all. One moment you were flying, the next moment to turn through 90 degrees. A very, very sudden, vicious stall. And to overcome this, they'd done all kinds of things. I can't remember now. We had fences, different types of tabs, different aileron rigging, you name it, we tried it. And eventually, by a combination of all these things, it got a COA, a civil COA. But,
the RAF wasn't as well,
wasn't it? That's right. I mean, to be perfectly honest, it was a disastrous aeroplane, really, because when it was finished, in fact, the old Hastings go higher, further, and take a heavier load than the damned Argosy could. The only thing it had was these doors that opened in the front. Anyway, it was a great experience. But
from there it was Avarez, was it?
From there it was Avarez, and quite a different life altogether, because we then launched out into a rather much more varied scene, because we were dealing really with three aeroplanes. There was the Vulcan programs. The poor old Shackleton was still going reasonably strong, and we had the Avro 748, the little turboprop airliner, was just being flown. So there was plenty of variety about the thing.
Was Jim Harrison chief test pilot?
Yes,
by that?
Jimmy was. Yes,
early Falkland left.
That's right, yeah. And we had a very brilliant chap, Jimmy's number two, called Tony Blackman. You ever heard of him? Very bright chap. Who I think is just... Well, he wrote the other day to say he was retiring from Smith's Instruments, where he'd been technical director and then marketing director, I think. He was a very, very good mathematician. And he virtually saw the auto land thing through on the Vulcan. And I did some flying with him on that, and it was really quite an education to see how Tony working on this, because we had a panel on which you could vary a whole lot of parameters in the cockpit, and we'd do these damn auto lands, and particularly in the crosswinds, which were very spooky. Tony could, with adjust these potentiometers, and there we go.
Was that the first military aircraft with auto land?
I don't know. I think they got it in a Varsity, didn't they?
Did they?
Yes. I think they flew it in a Varsity. Not sure. It worked jolly well, actually, and the thing that worked best in the Vulcan was the auto throttle. Actually superb. Really worked well.
And that was locked into the ILS, was it? Like the other ones?
Yeah. The early ones we did, I think, were with the cable system at Bedford. You know, they had a cable lead in to give you an accurate signal.
Was there a cable on the ground?
Yeah. But it worked very well. Very well indeed. Well, they were totally unnerving at first, you know, the great airplane, you know, thundering at the ground, hoping this damn thing was going to pull it out and put it on the runway. It was really quite exciting stuff. Yeah. Yep. Remarkable airplane, that Vulcan.
And was Avro's your last military flying, if you like, that you did?
Yes. That's right. But I ended up, really, the thing that made me, one of the reasons I left Avarez, and I think the other chaps did too, was not only was the pay not terribly good, but by this time the 748 had taken hold around the world, and one was forever being shot off to either sell the aeroplane to some overseas company, or having sold the aeroplane, convert the crews and get it into service. So, towards the end, which must have been about 1967-68, I'd only just got married too. And I can't remember, I'd done two trips to the spells in the Philippines, been to Venezuela, Chile, demonstration in Kashmir, I think. But he was almost continuously overseas by this time. Anyway, that's right. And finally, I got to doing a conversion at Austria in Vienna. That's right. And I think I better not tell that story. Anyway, so we decided to leave, and I went, and my chap who'd been number two with me at Gloucester's, Peter Varley, was already there. He got out about 6 months before I did, and we joined this court line, which was just starting up, because they'd been formed from oh dear, can you switch it off now? That's right, yes, Courtline were formed from Autair, and that's right, Pete and I went in as the jet experience chaps when they got 111s. And it really was a splendid company. It really was a good company because they didn't grudge any money at all on training. And in the end, we built up to a fleet of 12 111s. We commissioned our own 111 simulator. That was interesting, because I was given 3 months off to go to the factory, Redifons, to develop the simulator to the standard we wanted. So that was jolly good. I was very interested in that simulator development. And all was going splendidly until the company went bust. It was a great shit pity, because...
So you've got TriStars in as well.
That's right. But by the that's right, we just got the TriStars. But by the time... I'd never got my hands on one of those. But by the time it folded, Autair and Courtline have been going 12 years. And we never injured one single passenger. Not even... graze them, so we were rather proud of that. I'm doing a lot of flying, you can imagine 12 111s going day and night to all, it was very jungly in those days, it really was. I mean, if you were going into Split or Dubrovnik in the middle of the night, you really had to know what you're doing, because there were no proper aids, and you could have some pretty desperate scenes if you were people weren't up to it. But all the chaps were marvellous. Anyway, so then it went bust. What do we do then? Oh, that's right. Well, then it was a bad period. And in the end, some of us were able to go out to Malawi and start a jet conversion scene there, because, again, it's a bit of a long story, but Malawi was... in the hands of a very capable Irishman, whose name again I've forgotten, but he was very go ahead, and he saw the court line had gone bust, and he said, well, the best thing is to grab some of the crews, get 3 111s, and get the conversion started, because they got quite a good contract to fly miners from Malawi down to the mines in Johannesburg. And they'd also got little lines going to Lusaka and Kenya and Dar es Salaam and so on. So down we went. And I must say, it was quite a jolly scene. Excellent, as far as I was concerned, because my wife is a South African, and by then I had 3 little children. And Malawi used to fly us all out holidays, free, put us up in the hotel. I used to fly my family down to Johannesburg to stay with my in-law. It worked very well. And that went on for a bit. And then all turned to disaster, because I had to make the decision as to whether to take they offered me a 3-year contract as a training captain to stay out there with them. But a terrible disaster befell, because unbeknownst to me, or any of us, in fact, that, because all the hotel rooms were bugged in Blantyre. And came the day they got the tapes mixed up, I suppose, because they were being... tape machines were running in the cellars, presumably. Anyway, very ugly scene, in short, and I was confronted by four gigantic chaps who tore my room to pieces and confiscated my passport and everything else. And then uttered a solemn warning that if I mentioned a word of this to anybody, there'd be big, big trouble. And I said, well, this was all taking place about midnight. And when it, yes, that's right, the three of them went off down the corridor, and the fourth chap came back and put his back against the door. And he said, you were one word from you about any of this, and you'll never be heard of again, which wasn't very reassuring. I said, what the hell are you looking for? He said, just tell me. And he said, oh, it's not for you to say. We asked the questions. I thought it was... There were two things. Either unauthorized books or pornographic literature was the usual thing. I didn't know about this taping or whatnot. Anyway, I wasn't very happy. And I said to the child, I said, well, this is ridiculous, because I've got to fly for your airline tomorrow. I'm an Air Malawi pilot. You know, you must be mad. What are they going to say when I don't turn up? And they said, oh, you must go tomorrow. We have looked at your roster. You are not flying. That's right. I must have my passport to fly out of the country. He said, oh, we have looked at your roster. Tomorrow you are flying entirely within in Malawi. You're going up the lake to Katanga or something. He's absolutely right. Well, I thought, what the devil do I do here? Anyway, I need hardly say I spread the news around pretty quickly about my mates, what had happened. And in the morning, it was the day after, I can't remember now, the bearer came in at about half past six and said, there are some gentlemen want to see you in the hotel lobby. I'm interested. Oh, dear, I was thrown into the back of a police jeep and carted off. Well, I must admit, I was extremely scared. I really was. Eventually, I was taken off to the interrogation place at Zomba. I didn't have a very happy time. The chap who claimed he'd been trained by the, the Americans and the British how to interrogate subversive people. But, fortunately, I was completely clean, and he could see that in the end. He said, you know, I said, but, you know, you must be mad, because I'm flying your airline. Everybody knows me. How could I do anything? You know, he said, oh, no. So in the end, he conceded that there must be some mistake, and they got it all mixed up. So anyway, I eventually got back to Blantyre. And of course, the British High Commission people were absolutely useless. But anyway, there's nothing much I could do, except I thought, well, you know, this is not a good scene. So we didn't renew the contract, came back to UK and joined Monarch.